It is unlawful for a person to keep or maintain any dwelling for the purpose of using or keeping controlled substances. In a case where police observed the defendant leaving a hotel room and inside the room they found the defendant's wallet and a quantity of fentanyl, the Court of Appeals recently held the evidence was insufficient to establish that the defendant was keeping or maintaining the dwelling to use drugs. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Hollis, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
So, Joe, before we get to that keeping a dwelling case, there was another case involving the sufficiency of the state's evidence to rebut a claim of self-defense. Let's talk about State versus Barber.
State v. Barber, this was a case out of Stokes County. Defendant was a member of a Hare Krishna community and apparently lived next door to the victim, a man named Lawrence Anderson. Anderson frequently hosted members of the community at his home. There was evidence that the defendant and Lawrence were friends. On April 30th, 2021, Lawrence apparently used his new lawnmower to mow the defendant's lawn. His lawnmower got stuck in a ditch, and Lawrence left the lawnmower there and left the property to come back to get it later. The next day, the defendant called the sheriff's department about the mower. He said he didn't know whose it was, and he asked that the mower be towed away. Somebody came and got the mower. The mower was removed from the defendant's property. Later that day, Lawrence came onto the defendant's property with a tow strap, apparently intending to retrieve his lawnmower. There's surveillance video from the defendant's home. The video shows the subsequent interaction between the defendant and Lawrence. Defendant went inside the house and retrieved a shotgun from his home, apparently told Lawrence to leave the property. The surveillance video shows that Lawrence re-entered the yard. Defendant appeared again with his shotgun and shook his head negatively in response to something Lawrence had said. At that point, the surveillance video shows that Lawrence crossed the driveway. Defendant used his shotgun, shot the victim in the head. Lawrence died at the scene as a result of the shotgun wound to his head. Defendant was indicted for voluntary manslaughter. At the charge conference, defendant argued that language regarding excessive force should be removed from the instruction on defensive habitation. He agreed to an instruction that the presumption of reasonable fear applies, quote, absent evidence to the contrary. Defendant was convicted by a jury of voluntary manslaughter. The trial court entered judgment and the defendant appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant raised essentially three arguments, one with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, one with regard to plain error in the instructions, and then one about the closing argument. But turning first to that sufficiency of evidence argument, defendant claimed that the trial court erred by denying his motion to dismiss based on his Castle Doctrine defense. The Court of Appeals said a motion to dismiss should be allowed when the state and the defendant's evidence is to the same effect and tends only to exculpate the defendant. That's a North Carolina Supreme Court case from 1961 called State v. Carter. Here, the Court of Appeals distinguished Carter, explaining that in that case, the state and the defendant's evidence was essentially the same. By contrast, in this case, the state presented evidence to contradict defendant's Castle Doctrine defense. And the Court of Appeals looked to a number of factors there, particularly, it said, in the present case, the trial court considered the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. Such contradictory evidence included evidence that it was common for neighbors to come onto each other's property, the long and friendly relationship between Lawrence and defendant, evidence Lawrence was searching for his lawnmower, video footage of the entire incident, video footage Lawrence was casually walking near defendant rather than bearing down on defendant, as defendant had claimed, and video footage that Lawrence was not even looking in the defendant's direction when defendant shot him. The Court of Appeals said that when there is contradictory evidence, it is for the jury to determine whether the Castle Doctrine applies, and therefore the trial court did not err in this case by denying the defendant's motion to dismiss. With regard to the jury instructions, defendant argued that the trial court plainly erred by instructing the jury that the Castle Doctrine presumption could be rebutted without regard to the statutory factors listed in General Statute 14-51.2. The Court of Appeals recognized, based on the Supreme Court's case State v. Phillips, that the Castle Doctrine statutory presumption may be rebutted only by the circumstances listed in the statute. That's one of the errors that Phillips had identified, and it was an error also that the Court of Appeals in an earlier case called State v. Thomas found amounted to plain error. Here, the Court of Appeals said the trial court's failure to recite the factors was error, but the defendant failed to show that he was prejudiced by that error, that it had a probable effect on the verdict. The Court of Appeals distinguished State v. Thomas, where it had found plain error in the Castle Doctrine instructions, saying that unlike in Thomas, the evidence in this case regarding whether Lawrence's entry was forceful or unlawful distinguishes it from Thomas. And then the third issue with regard to the closing argument, defendant argued that the trial court erred by failing to intervene ex mere motu in the state's closing argument. The prosecutor had made a number of claims in closing argument. I'm going to read you a little bit of that argument now. He said, so in this situation, we have a homeowner who wants to remove a trespasser. The homeowner is not removing a killer or an assailant. He is removing a trespasser. So he is entitled to force, but not more force, not excessive force, not more force than necessary to accomplish that object. It would have been within his rights to put his hands on Lawrence if that's what it would have taken, but you can't use deadly force until deadly force is being used against you. The Court of Appeals said the jury was instructed on both the Castle Doctrine and self-defense as requested. It acknowledged that the state's closing argument, quote, does appear to conflate the complete self-defense law with the Castle Doctrine, but it ultimately found that the error, if there was one, was not so grossly improper as to require the trial court to intervene ex mere motu. And so ultimately it found that there was no prejudicial error and upheld the defendant's conviction for voluntary manslaughter.
So, Joe, I mean, I understand on that first issue where they're saying, we agree with the trial court, we would not grant the motion to dismiss based on this, you know, self-defense or Castle Doctrine when there is this conflicting evidence about it. Help me understand a little bit on the jury instruction part, because, I mean, they are acknowledging that the instructions given were incorrect, right? But then they're just sort of saying it is not probable that the jury's determination would have differed with the additional instructions. Are they sort of explaining to us how we get to that conclusion?
Just based on the analysis the Court of Appeals did, it looks like the defendant was really relying on that earlier case, State v. Thomas. That was a Court of Appeals case from 2025. In Thomas, the jury instructions with the Castle Doctrine, it says, were substantially the same as in the present case. But the Court of Appeals said, we determined that Thomas is distinguishable. I think that's consistent with the notion that this determination of prejudice has to be determined on a case-by-case basis. What might constitute plain error in one case is not necessarily going to constitute plain error in the other, because a plain error analysis looks at what other evidence was presented. In this particular case, I think the Court of Appeals was more inclined to find this to be harmless error, partly because you had the whole interaction on surveillance video. They specifically, as I said, distinguished Thomas by saying there wasn't so much of an issue as to whether Lawrence's entry was forceful or unlawful. They were able to use that fact to distinguish Thomas. So whereas Thomas had found this essentially same error to count as plain error, in this case, the Court of Appeals was not willing to go so far. It said, on the facts of this case, as opposed to Thomas, we do not believe the defendant proved that the jury's verdict probably would have differed with proper instructions.
You know, ever since Phillips, I've heard a lot of prosecutors talking about this, that there's that language in Phillips about, hey, listen, this decision is not intended to declare open season on trick-or-treaters or Girl Scouts who come to your front door. And I think there has been some concern out there saying that, you know, notwithstanding the language in that opinion, it does seem to open the door to deadly force being used in a lot of circumstances where we might not immediately think of that as a typical kind of self-defense. Do you think this is a little bit of maybe the Court of Appeals kind of pushing back the other way of trying to, you know, set some limits on that and say we are going to look at some of these factors and the conflicting evidence and try to take a broader view of what's really going on in the case?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, those Castle Doctrine statute has been around since 2011, and it's only within the last few years that we have some North Carolina Supreme Court precedent purporting to construe that and kind of explain how those presumptions are supposed to work and what the jury has to determine. But yeah, there remains that there's language in Phillips that kind of cuts both ways, because at the same time that it's granting a justification to use deadly force in defense of the home, it also says, as the Court of Appeals quoted here, we're not declaring open season on Girl Scouts and trick-or-treaters. So yeah, what I see is the Court of Appeals struggling to make sense of that language in Phillips that appears at times to be a little in tension with itself. I think it's certainly true that the Court of Appeals is concerned that the public not get the wrong impression that they can just shoot anybody that comes onto the property.
And yet, I mean, I would agree with you. It does kind of feel like tension sometimes, because we're saying, hey, this is not intended to be open season on, you know, anybody who just, I don't know, almost accidentally, pushes their way through your front door. And yet at the same time, you know, we have the language of the statute and we have the holding from Phillips that says the only things that will rebut that presumption of reasonable fear are these things listed out in the statute. And we're going to be bound to that. So it does... Makes it kind of difficult.
Another thing, too, that justification, or at least the presumption of reasonable fear, is not triggered under the statute unless there has been an unlawful enforceable entry.
Sure, sure.
So the state is going to be in a position, I think, in a lot of these cases to argue, look, that presumption wasn't even triggered here because whatever entry occurred was not unlawful and enforceable. And I think this precise meaning of those two terms is still being worked out by some of these cases. In a case like this, where there's evidence of this ongoing relationship between these neighbors, where the victim apparently frequently came onto the property to rake leaves and to mow the lawn, there's at least a colorable argument from the prosecutor's side. This was not an unlawful enforceable entry. Now, after the defendant had forbidden this person from being on the property, maybe it becomes unlawful. It being unlawful alone is not enough. It has to be both unlawful and forcible. So when do you cross that line?
Yeah.
I think that's something the Court of Appeals is still wrestling with.
Yeah, but I think you make a good point. That, I think, is a good takeaway for our prosecutors, is even if there is this kind of narrow and strict interpretation under Phillips, I mean, this is another argument we could look at. Sure, that is the interpretation under Phillips, but are we even there yet?
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, does it even apply to the situation that we're actually looking at?
There's language in Phillips, I think, to support that, and the later North Carolina Supreme Court case called Allison that kind of reiterated a lot of what Philip said, that statutory presumption of reasonable fear is not even triggered until you have an unlawful enforceable entry and the defendant knows it or has reasonable grounds to know that an unlawful enforceable entry is occurring. I think the second case we had on for today was State v. Hollis.
Right. So this is the one that was mentioned in the introduction. This is another case we got from the Court of Appeals on March 4th of 2026, a case out of Rutherford County. The defendant in this case lived with his girlfriend, but on this particular evening, this is back in October of 2021, he wanted to have a rendezvous with another woman that was not his girlfriend without his girlfriend's knowledge. So a family member of his had been renting a hotel room at a nearby Baymont Inn in Forest City. So the defendant said that he gave this person $20 in exchange for permission to come over to that motel room with this other woman. So the defendant, the woman, and the person who actually rented the room, Logan, partied in that room for some period of time. And the defendant would later testify that he just gave him, you know, $20 and some beer, that kind of thing, that he wasn't staying there or living there, but he did stay in that room that evening. The following day, this is October 13th of 2021, he comes back to the hotel room. He would say to retrieve a shoebox for some tennis shoes that he had left behind. He doesn't have a key for the room because, of course, it's rented by this other person, but he is able to ask the housekeeper at the hotel to let him in, and the housekeeper got permission from the manager and did open the door to let him go in. Unbeknownst to the defendant, as the opinion says, Forest City police officers were doing surveillance on that hotel, and they saw the defendant leave the room and drive away. So they followed his vehicle, conducted a traffic stop on that, and while they're doing a traffic stop and a search of his vehicle, another officer goes and gets a search warrant for the room that they had been in, which was room 208. When they do the search of that room back at the hotel, they find a wallet on the nightstand that has the defendant's identification in it. There's a debit or a credit card with his name on it, some cash. There's no other personal identifying documents of any other person that are found in the room. And then significantly, they find 37 of what they call small yellow pills that they suspect to be fentanyl, along with digital scales. Those are later tested and confirmed that they are, in fact, fentanyl pills. They speak with the defendant about, you know, being in the room, and he tells them that he had been staying there for a while, but he had gone that day and just sort of forgotten and laid his wallet down. He also made a statement about those pills. In the detective's words later at trial, would say that the defendant made a statement as to the pills that were found being from or for his girlfriend, and they had gotten them from her baby daddy. So the defendant ultimately is charged and is convicted at a jury trial with one count of being guilty of trafficking in opium or heroin, a class F felony, and also, as you mentioned in the introduction, Joe, for knowingly keeping or maintaining a dwelling for controlled substances. In this particular case, it was just charged as the class one misdemeanor version. So on appeal, after these convictions, the defendant is challenging the denial of his motion to dismiss on the charge of keeping or maintaining a dwelling for controlled substances, and the Court of Appeals agrees. They say that there was insufficient evidence for that in this case. I mentioned the defendant was charged with the class one version, the class one misdemeanor for keeping or maintaining a dwelling. I think we more commonly see it charged as the class I felony. It can be a felony if it's done intentionally or if the person tries to bar entry of law enforcement. But in this case, it was just the class one misdemeanor, but the elements otherwise are basically going to be the same. So the Court of Appeals walks through that and says, based on our case law, we have a list of factors that we look at to determine whether or not a person charged with this really was keeping or maintaining that dwelling for the purpose of controlled substances. And they say that there are several factors. None of them are dispositive, but as the case law has laid out over the years, they include things like occupancy of the property, payment of rent, possession over a duration of time, having the key that's used to get in, payments for utilities or repair expenses of the property. They say a pivotal question under the statute is whether there is evidence that the defendant owned, leased, maintained, or was otherwise responsible for the premises. And other factors finally include things like presence of a large amount of cash on the premises or defendant's admission to selling controlled substances and the existence of drug paraphernalia. So we have some of that here, right? We found these 37 odd pills. There's digital scales. The defendant's identifying debit and credit card are found in there. And then, of course, he's acknowledged being in there. But nevertheless, the Court of Appeals says in this case, that was insufficient to establish that he was maintaining or keeping that dwelling under the relevant statute 90-108A7. They say that the defendant's wallet in the room was the only evidence for which the state established defendant's purported ownership, and that standing alone, in their view, was insufficient. The rest of the opinion goes through looking at some case precedent that they turn to for guidance on this, and some kind of going both ways. They mention a case called State versus Tony, for example, where the defendant occupied a room for one night and then was present during the search, but there was no evidence that he had paid for the room or was a registered guest in the room. And in that case, they likewise said that's insufficient to show keeping or maintaining. They talk about another case, State versus Harris, again, where they found insufficient evidence. That was one where a defendant occupied the property from time to time, but none of his personal papers actually listed that as being the defendant's address. On the other hand, they mention a case called State versus Rogers, which has an interesting discussion in there about, because, you know, we do have both of these terms, right? Keeping or maintaining. And that Rogers case I thought was interesting because they have a long quote in there from that case. And they give the example of somebody who is keeping a shop, for example. I mean, even if I just opened this new business 3 minutes ago, the idea that I am keeping this shop, I'm the owner, the operator of the store, that sort of indicates this intent to continue to do so for some period of time going forward. So not that there's a definite time element, as they say, no one factor is dispositive, but they say, even referring back to that State v. Rogers case, the possession must have occurred for at least a short period of time, or the circumstances must indicate an intent to retain that property in the future, and in many cases, both may be evident. So looking and comparing these facts to those cases, they say there just wasn't sufficient evidence here for the trial court to, in their words, the trial court relied on the defendant's presence in the room and the discovery of his wallet and cash on the nightstand to submit the charge to the jury. But that evidence standing alone just was not sufficient to support that conviction.
Jonathan, did you find this result surprising? Because I kind of did. I mean, would it have been different, do you think, if the police had waited for the defendant to return for his wallet?
Right. So, you know, he tells them he's coming back because he left this shoebox behind, right? I mean, from when they were all partying in the room the night before, he's coming back for the shoebox.
I mean, the cops saw him leave the room, right?
Right.
You know, he's been in there.
So, and I mean, you know, you make a good point. I mean, either he's leaving his wallet behind on purpose because he's planning to come back, or if not, then he's probably going to be coming back, you know, a third time. Maybe that would establish some higher level of occupancy and control. But I mean, even then, they refer to that State v. Harris, a case from 2003, and that's a quote, "The defendant occupied the property from time to time, although none of the defendant's personal papers listed the duplex as the defendant's address." I think they are really contrasting the couple of things the state does have with all the other things the state does not have, right? I mean, this room is rented in somebody else's name. He's the person who's actually staying there, and defendant doesn't have a key, right?
It's
he has to ask
somebody else's name because he was having an affair.
Again, I don't know all the facts, but the way they set it up is that they make it sound like the friend is already staying at the hotel, and then the defendant, in this case, is essentially kind of using that as a location to have this rendezvous. And so, you know, Joe, you and I think we talked about this case once before, and I guess my analogy would be if I was invited to a party at your house and then realized I had left my cell phone sitting on your coffee table, if your neighbor has a key and I'm a friend of Joe Hyde's, can you let me in? I left my phone and then the neighbor lets me in. would I feel like I should be responsible for everything that is found in your basement? You know, even if that's some kind of illegal controlled substances, perhaps not. But you know, I mean, do I find it surprising or a little disappointing? I mean, well, you know, hey, I'm a prosecutor. So yes, I mean, you know, the answer is going to be yes, because I do think there's some other stuff we could talk about, right? He's not challenging his conviction for the trafficking on the fentanyl, right? I mean, I think there's evidently—
Which means the state had to establish his possession or control, at least constructively, of the drugs that were found in the hotel room, right?
Right, right. You know, and he makes that incriminating statement to them. He has knowledge about these pills, right? He says something to them about how that they were from, you know, this other woman's father of her child. They either got them from him or for her. So he's got some knowledge or interaction with those pills. And then, yeah, I mean, he is leaving his wallet, leaving his shoebox. He's able to get in the room. He spent some extended period of time there the night before. He has no hesitation about coming back, whether the lawful or you know, registered occupant of the room is there or not. I guess a case like this, as evidenced by the outcome in this case, could go either way, right? I mean, you know, that on review, the appellate court might look at it and say, no one factor is dispositive, right? It's never going to be a dead-on guarantee that we've got sufficient evidence because we have this factor or that factor. And so we definitely want to tease out and establish in the testimony everything we possibly can. And again, I don't have the transcript. I don't know what did or didn't happen in this case. But, you know, maybe we could really develop the testimony about just how long was he there the night before? And how many times, if it's true, did that other person leave? You know, just leave him and this other woman in the room alone? You know, that he's something to build it up a little bit more, that we are essentially sharing or ceding some control or occupancy of the room to this other person. Maybe that would be enough to get us over the hump. As they say, there's no bright line on total amount of time, but it's just this idea that you've had some possession of it, you've had control over it, and it's for some period of time or an intent to continue to do so in the future. So whatever else we could lay down to establish that would be helpful in a case like this. But here, with evidently, in their view, nothing except a shoebox and a wallet and popping back in to a motel room that was registered to somebody else, on these particular facts, the Court of Appeals said that was insufficient evidence for maintaining a dwelling. And then, Joe, I think our last one is State versus Hunt.
State v. Hunt. This was a case out of Robeson County. Facts took place back in January of 2019. The defendant at that time apparently veered off the road when he was driving. He struck Timothy Todd with his Ford F-250 while Todd was riding his ATV in the driveway, causing multiple injuries. Todd was unconscious in the hospital for about 6 weeks. In July of 2020, a defendant was indicted for assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, injury to personal property, and habitual felon status. Matter came on for trial in March of 2023. At trial, a witness to the crash testified that the defendant actually revved his engine before running over the victim. Apparently, when the defendant got out of his truck, he accused the victim of trespassing, of being on, of riding his ATV on his property without his permission. State Trooper Kyle Covington, who responded to the scene of the collision, opined that the collision was quote-unquote intentional, based on his review of the circumstances. At trial, the victim testified to incurring $525,000 in medical bills and $42,000 in air flight bills. That becomes relevant to the determination later on of the amount of restitution. During the charge conference, the parties agreed to an instruction: if you decide that certain evidence is believable, you must then determine the importance of that evidence in light of all other believable evidence in the case. When it came time to instruct the jury, the trial court actually said, you must decide that certain evidence is believable. In other words, deviated from this agreed upon instruction, but there was no objection to that language. Defendant was convicted of the lesser included offense of assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, injury to personal property. He was also sentenced as an habitual felon, and then the defendant appealed. This went up to the Court of Appeals once before. In an opinion issued in October of 2024, the Court of Appeals majority, over a dissent, held that the defendant was entitled to a new trial based on plain error in allowing the trooper Kyle Covington to testify as a lay witness that the collision was intentional. The state sought review of that determination, and the North Carolina Supreme Court vacated the Court of Appeals decision and remanded for reconsideration in light of State v. Reber. Reber was a case that the Supreme Court decided in 2024, clarifying the standard for plain error review, that is, reviewing an alleged error when there was no objection to that issue below. So this was back before the Court of Appeals on remand from the Supreme Court, and the first issue they addressed was that question of whether Trooper Covington was permitted to testify that the collision was intentional. The Court of Appeals recognized that under State v. Reber, to show plain error, a defendant must establish three different things. First, that the trial court committed fundamental error. Secondly, that the error had a probable impact on the verdict. And third, that this is an exceptional case, meaning that the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. The Court of Appeals addressed each one of those factors and basically found that the defendant established none of those. With regard to whether the trial court committed fundamental error, the Court of Appeals said that under Evidence Rule 701, a lay witness may opine on a matter rationally based on his perception, including common inferences derived from appearance, condition, and mental or physical state of persons. Here, Trooper Covington based his opinion on his rational observation and instantaneous conclusions at the scene. So the Court of Appeals concluded the defendant failed to show there was a fundamental error.
Wait. Can we take a time out real quick? So I thought you said earlier that the Court of Appeals found that it was an improper expert opinion on accident reconstruction, and then the Supreme Court sent it back saying that they were erroneously finding that to rise to the level of being plain error.
Right.
But now on remand of whether or not it was plain error, you're saying they're actually going a different way on whether it was error at all?
Yeah, that's a little curious, right? The earlier Court of Appeals opinion, based on some earlier, by which I mean pre-rules cases, decided that this opinion of a lay witness invaded the province of the jury when he told the jury that this accident appeared to the witness to be intentional. But now, given the chance to reconsider this, and I don't think there's not a problem in terms of the law of the case or anything like that, because the Supreme Court vacated the opinion, sent it back for reconsideration. And on the second time around, the Court of Appeals comes out differently on whether this was evidentiary error at all.
Huh.
Now, they don't say squarely that this was not error and admissible, but the conclusion they reached was this was not fundamental error, primarily because it seemed to suggest at any rate that it was permissible for this lay opinion to be admitted at trial, for the trooper to testify that his opinion was rationally based on his perception, including common inferences derived from appearance, condition, and the state of persons. Yeah, basically, the Court of Appeals second time around came out differently on whether this constituted evidentiary error at all. But then they go on to address those other two factors as well. With regard to whether there was a probable impact on the verdict, the Court of Appeals concluded that defendant also failed to show that this influenced the outcome. And it reached that result by looking at the other evidence that the state presented of the defendant's state of mind. That evidence included the witness's testimony that the defendant revved his engine before running over the victim's ATV. There was photo evidence of the crash. There was evidence that there were no skid marks, what they called no brake marks. This was another thing that played into the trooper's opinion that this collision was an intentional act on the part of defendant. And then the third Reber factor, whether this was an exceptional case, the Court of Appeals said the defendant also failed to show that this was an exceptional case. The defendant apparently didn't even argue that this was exceptional or met those requirements, that the error seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. So considering all those elements together, the Court of Appeals concluded that there was no plain error in the trial court's admission of that lay opinion testimony. The defendant also apparently argued that he received ineffective assistance of counsel when counsel failed to object to the law enforcement officer's testimony. The Court of Appeals acknowledged that the test for prejudice under the plain error standard and the test for prejudice for ineffective assistance of counsel are not identical. That's a Supreme Court case called State v. Lane. Nevertheless, it found that the defendant failed to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome, such as to rise to the level of prejudice under the test for ineffective assistance of counsel. It says, as discussed above, the state offered ample additional evidence to support a finding of intentionality, so the defendant failed to show not only plain error, but also failed to show that he received ineffective assistance of counsel in defense counsel's failure to object to the lay opinion testimony. There were a couple other issues in this case, including the closing argument issue and a jury instruction issue. With regard to the closing argument issue, the defendant argued the trial court erred by failing to intervene ex mere motu in closing arguments when the prosecutor stated that the defendant got back into his truck and backed out over the victim's legs. The Court of Appeals recognized that the trial court need not intervene unless the argument strays so far from the bounds of propriety as to impede the defendant's right to a fair trial. Absent objection, a reviewing court reviews closing arguments for gross impropriety. Here, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that the prosecutor, quote, misstated or overstated the evidence in saying that the defendant intentionally backed over the victim's legs, but the Court of Appeals concluded those statements were not so grossly improper as to warrant a new trial. There was a jury instruction issue that had to do with that deviation from the agreed upon instruction. It says the Court of Appeals said when the trial court agrees to give an instruction and then deviates, that error is preserved even absent objection. but a deviation requires a new trial only if there is a reasonable possibility that the error affected the verdict. And here the Court of Appeals found no probable impact on the verdict. So at least with regard to the conviction, with regard to the trial issues, it found no prejudicial error. They did, however, find a problem both with the habitual felon indictment and with the issue of restitution. To address the habitual felon issue first, the defendant argued that his habitual felon indictment was fatally defective because it listed two ineligible prior convictions. Under General Statute 14-7.1, for habitual felon status, the predicate felonies must be sequential and non-overlapping, meaning that each subsequent felony must have been committed after conviction of the preceding felony. Here, the defendant's habitual felon indictment alleged three prior felony convictions that overlapped. The March and April 1993 offenses were committed before the conviction was entered for the prior September 1992 offense. So the Court of Appeals concluded that the habitual felon indictment was fatally defective. It vacated the judgment and remanded for resentencing without the habitual felon enhancement. And then finally, there was that issue of restitution. The defendant argued that the trial court's restitution award of $592,000 was not supported by evidence. The Court of Appeals acknowledged that restitution must be based on sufficient evidence. It said the quantum of evidence needed is not high, but the evidence must be competent, specific, and reliable. Here, the victim testified to medical bills of $525,000 and a medical flight bill of $42,000, which would be a total of $567,000. At sentencing, however, the prosecutor misstated the total, and the trial court entered an award of $592,000. The Court of Appeals said the record would support a maximum award of $567,000, that is, the total of the two amounts testified by the victim. But it also said that the victim's testimony was approximate, that the state misstated the amount, and that no party introduced medical bills or other corroborative evidence. As a result of that, the Court of Appeals vacated the restitution order, that total that was supported by no competent evidence, and remanded for a new hearing to determine the amount.
So, Joe, this was the issue. I know it's, you know, it's the last one they address, and it's not a huge part of the opinion, but this is the one that really caught my eye on this question of restitution. I mean, because I don't think they're saying that witness or victim testimony alone could never be enough to establish the amount of restitution at issue. I think I'm reading this to say that it's just insufficient here because it was not specific, right? It was just this sort of generalized or approximated. We've got a victim saying, my medical bills were about $525,000. I mean, certainly, I mean, I guess if we have the medical bills or if the victim can bring those in, then, I mean, by all means, of course, we would want to try to, you know, get that kind of documentation to back it up. But I guess my question for you would be, if I had a victim up on the stand without that additional documentation, but sir, do you know what your medical bills were? Yes, I do. They were $538,000. You know, I mean, more specific, or would that, do you think, then be sufficient, even if I didn't have the paperwork for it?
Yeah, the problem here is that there is both the obvious error just in calculation, and also the Court of Appeals added this additional language about saying that the victim's testimony was vague, that it was an approximation. So you can't tell exactly whether this result that the Court of Appeals reached, vacating the restitution, remanding for redetermination, was based only on the misstatement of the amount, so that the total was not supported by any evidence at all, or whether it was also because there wasn't this corroborative evidence, including like documentation or medical bills or something like that. I think in another case, the state would be in a better position if they had both a witness who testified very specifically what the amount was and could offer some additional corroborative evidence, documentation, paperwork, bills, something like that to show what that number was. But as to whether a victim who testifies very specifically, I know the amount was this figure exactly, whether that would be sufficient, I don't think there's anything in this Court of Appeals opinion to support a conclusion that that would be inadequate. And I base that on where the Court of Appeals said the record supports a maximum award of $567,000. So even despite calling this an approximation, where the victim testified to certain figures and those figures added together reaches that amount, 567, they say the record would support at least an award of that figure. Now, they don't go on to say without other documentation, but right. I think that's implied.
That's sort of what I've been struggling with, too. You know, when they talk about it, they say, because the only evidence was either estimated or misstated and uncorroborated, it falls short of the specificity required. I think still a little bit of an open question for me as well. You know, the one case they referenced, that State v. Buchanan, was the same thing, vacating a restitution award where they say the victim described it as being about $10,000 in bills and then no corroborating evidence. So I don't know. I mean, if a person knew, yeah, it was worth exactly this much or my bills were exactly this high, maybe that would be enough to get to that level of specificity that's required.
Yeah. And like I said, from this opinion, you can't really tell whether the problem is one of quantity or quality, because in this case, it might have been both. But there's certainly a quantitative problem because the addition was just wrong.
Right.
So on that alone, they sent it back here.
But if nothing else, a takeaway for our prosecutors would be to be aware that this can be an issue. So especially in a case like this, where we're talking about whether it's the higher or lower number, in excess of $500,000 person is out, if at all possible, if we can get that paperwork to back it up, just to make sure we're not only relying on that estimate from the victim.
And let me say one more thing about that habitual felon issue, because this is interesting to me in light of State v. Singleton. That was the case we got from a couple years ago where the Supreme Court is backing away from those common law strict indictment rules. The result now after Singleton is even the omission of an element of the offense might not be a fatal defect, might not deprive the trial court of jurisdiction. What we see here is that the Court of Appeals continues to apply pre-Singleton rules with regard to habitual felon indictments, that even if an indictment for a substantive offense might not be entirely vitiated by the omission of an element, for habitual felon indictments, you still have to comply with these statutory requirements. So if you don't have these sequential and non-overlapping felonies, you're going to have a problem with your habitual felon indictment moving forward. Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Barber, holding the state presented sufficient evidence contradicting the defendant's Castle Doctrine defense, State v. Hollis, finding insufficient evidence that the defendant kept or maintained a hotel room for controlled substances, and State v. Hunt, vacating the defendant's sentence when his habitual felon indictment did not allege three sequential and non-overlapping prior convictions. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in beautiful Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.